Okay, so we have been speaking about Lishma and Lo Lishma, and we talked a little about Piggle. What I want to do here is, so sometimes to understand a halacha, you have to do a deep dive. And sometimes to understand something properly, you need to take a bird's eye view and look at something from a very broad perspective. That's what we're going to do here, which both methodologically speaking, sometimes you have to do that, and B, right, in order to emphasize the point that I've been making, that sometimes to understand halacha, like, you know, you need to understand everything, right? You need to have a broader view. So here, where we've been talking about the machshava of lo lishma, the question of whether thought has a place in halacha, or whether it has to be verbalized or something like that, to understand that in any area of halacha, we need a broad view, because in each area of halacha, you need two things. One is an understanding of the status of speech versus thought, and the second is an understanding of the localized halacha you're dealing with, which may have unique qualities that will push you in one direction or another. Right? So that is what we're going to do. It'll take us a little bit of time. I have no intention of rushing through this. Right? I want to really understand this. And frame it. Okay, so we're going to start here with the Gilyon HaShas. Now, Gilyon HaShas is a, this is Rav Yosef Engel, this is a late Achron, but he starts you off. If you want even more sources than I gave you, and I understand that I gave you a lot of sources, then you can look at the Knesset Rishonim, which is a collection of Rishonim by Rav Ilan Alseder Adaf, in Numbers 9 to 18. But let's start off with this. Okay, so we've talked about Lo lishma, lishma. The pasuk, at least by Piggle, that was invoked was lo yechashev, right? Which implies, if I asked you in a vacuum, what does machshava mean? What is machshevet? And in our Gemara, on Daf Bet, on Daf Dalet, machshevet lishma, machshevet lo lishma. What would I say machshava means?
Thought.
Very good. Why, as Evan already noted last week, should I wonder whether that is correct? You can't prove it. Therefore what? Good. So first of all, there's the epistemic problem, which is if you haven't articulated, how is anyone supposed to know this carbon is valid or invalid? We don't know what you said. We don't know what's going on in your head. Worse than that is that on Daf Chavtet, we have an argument about whether you get Malkut. Right? Now, the Gemara there says that hangs on whether you think that you get Malkut for Lav Sheyesh or Ein Boma, for a Lav Sheyesh or Ein Boma, right? For a prohibition that doesn't have an active component to it. Fine, but there's an epistemic problem here. Is if you think Machshava is in your head, then forget the formal problem. Do you get Malkut for something that doesn't have an action? There is. How are you ever going to prove it? To punish someone in court, it's one thing to say that God will punish you. But to say that the court could punish you, you need proof.
As of yet, it is still impossible to prove
what people are thinking. I said as of yet. As of yet. I understand. Okay, I get it. You know, we'll be able to read minds. Got it. Fine. Yeah, sure. Far be it from me to predict what will or will not be technologically possible in 5 years, in 10 years. Sure, we'll be able to read the future and read your mind, and then we'll be in, you know, the nightmare of Minority Report, right, where we punish people for crimes they haven't done yet, which is a great movie if you ever get around to it. Old movie, but great movie. Oh, it's so trippy. So weird. What? Minority Report. It's a really terrifying movie. What? Or you can read 1984, and then we're getting into, you know, thoughts, and yeah, that also really scary book, you know, really quite classic, but really quite
inspiring.
What? Inspiring. I mean, that is how they approach it in China, because that's basically where they are these days. Yeah. There are things going on in China or like Qatar that make 1984 look like nothing. You know, Qatar is, you know, during the World Cup, it was just like, wow. Wow, I mean, wow.
And yet Hamas still managed to hide there.
Yeah.
No, because it's
not. Okay. Anyways, I don't need to get into it. But the point is, yeah, it's still quite hard at the moment to get into people's heads and actually know what they're thinking. I'm not saying we won't be able to do it. I don't think we will, but who knows? I don't think you can read the mind in that way, but hey, who knows? So we got to figure out is, does machshava mean machshava? So right off the bat, the Gilyan HaShah sends you to a few sources just to get the ball rolling. Okay, so first, in our very first Tosfot, which has all types of wonderful, important things going on in this Tosfot. If you would like, we can read through all of it. Would you like to read through all of it? I know people were struggling through the first Tosfot. So he only gets this point towards the end, but he has a lot of important things for Sugya that we've seen. So we can read through it quickly. So he says, "Kol hazvachem shenizbechu, avoda kamaita nakat." The reason we focus on Zvicha, which is Shechita, is because that's first. But v'hu adin kabbalah v'alacha v'zrika. But the first thing he notes is that the rules of Lishma and LaLishma apply to all the avodah. Kidiktani seifa v'shuni kodesh shayach manach arba avodah. Then Tosfot further argues, and we're going to come back to some of these points, that shinui kodesh, right, meaning I'm thinking that a shlamim is an ola, that invalidation applies by all four avodah. So at this point, any, because this is on the first line of the Mishnah before the Gemara distinguished. Kigon olo l'shlem shlamim avol shinui bailem lo shayach ela bizrika. Right, but then he introduces his first point, is that thinking that the karban that was supposed to be Rabbi's is really Evan's, right, that is only possible by zrika. Kigon shocher mekabam ol karban ruven amal izrok domo l'shem shimon, meaning you do the other avoda on within having in mind that you are going to do zrika for the other person. Ruchel kamon bepirken v'tzarech l'daktik, and you have to be very precise. Minala elashas shinui bailim dekaboy lekamon bepirken minala and minan zvicha l'shma v'hader kamon ashkana shinui kodesh shinui bailim minala. Right, so the Gemara had later said that we learn out shinui bailim from an extra phrase by Shinoi Kodesh. Meimashim that we didn't kai. V'kula matinin lo mishtameh klal Shinoi Bailim. Right, so the first thing the Tosfot notes is this is odd. Right, the Gemara later on takes it as obvious that Shinoi Bailim and Shinoi Kodesh are related, when our Mishnah does not yet assume that. The Lishna de Lishman, mashim lefuki Shinoi Kodesh. Right, because as Lishma and lo Lishma at first glance does not apply to Shinoi Bailim because it's still brought as a carbon. And we already talked about this a little bit in Davdala, that in order to say that Shinui Bailim actually is similar to Shinui Kodesh in any way, you have to assume that a carbon isn't just Shlomim, and then it happens to be Rabbi's, but rather that its very definition is Rabbi Shlomim. Because then bringing it as Evan Shlomim is actually a change in its essence, not just a redirection. You know, or whatever, if you want a, you know, a geometric metaphor, right? To assume that a carbon is more like a vector than a scalar, right? Where the direction is part of its definition, right? Did that go over Bill's head? This is basic geometry, people, right? Yes? No? The direction is not part of its definition, right? Meaning the point is here, right? If a carbon is like a vector, so where to whom it is going, for whom it is being brought, is part of its definition. Come on, guys. Basics, people. V'chula matnidin lo nakeh el shinei kodesh, tiktani nami seifa. But our Mishnah says, shinei kodesh, keitzat lishman, v'shalol lishman, l'shem pezat, l'shalei shlamim. So the Gemara says, v'nira desomach amatnidin lekamon. We're relying on the Mishnah later on. Okay? So we're going to come back to this point, which is to what extent Shinui Kodesh is like Shinui Bailim. Okay? Let's skip down out to the end, but just, I know it's being unfair because you struggled through it, but don't worry. It isn't our next Makarot Chit. Whenever we finish this, we're going to come back to this Tosfot. But if you look at the very, very end, he says, look, when I say that machshava invalidates by karbanot, I deal with this question. Is it machshava or dibor? Right, that is the question that we want to take up. Okay? And if you look on Daf Dalet Amud Bet, that's the next quote Tosfot that he quotes here in Divrei Ma'akil Machshava. Right, so Tosfot there says what? Which one is it? Machshava be'alma. Right, so you remember? I remember I said follow. Right, so the first Tosfot on Dalam and Bet, that's the next one he quotes, that the Gemara had said that Shinui Kodesh is Machshava be'alma. So what does the words Machshava be'alma sound like? Thought alone. You would think the words thought alone would mean thought. Does that prove that it's thought? Tosfot says,
no.
Vafil yetzarach dibor. Even if you were to conclude that it needs speech, kaven deleka masa heva kemachshava ba'alma. Since you don't need action, so what is Tosfot saying? Why is there an ambiguity? Because sometimes machshava means thought, and sometimes machshava means
words,
not action. I.e., right? Meaning, Tosfot's point, the problem is that sometimes it's clear that thought means thought. Sometimes it's not clear because the default you would have assumed would be that you need action. And therefore we can say that something only requires thought. What we mean is it doesn't require action. Right? That's the ambiguity that Tosfot what? Right, meaning there is that you invalidate the carbon through non-action. Whether that's speech or thought, it's still not an action, because in general, action, right? So, now he quotes a bunch of sources, right? But if you look, right, here, let's look at some that I gave you here. So, Rashi Menachot Dafet. What does Rashi Menachot Dafet think? Number two, Ava Machshava de Minkira. Lechol Shehu Mechazev Loave Machshava. Hach Machshava de Kachim. Hotzat Dibur Bepet. Rashi and Menachot clearly says that Machshava means Dibur, talking. Kidarminu Bava Mitzia. As it says in Bava Mitzia, Al Kol Divar Pesha. So the Gemara there is talking about Shlichut Yad, which we'll get to. What's Shlichut Yad? Is when I am a shomer, I am a custodian of someone else's property, and then I choose to sort of steal it, meaning I didn't do an act of stealing, but I choose to start treating it as my own, which is a form of stealing. So the Gemara assumes that as soon as I'm Shaleach Yad, as soon as I begin to extend ownership over the object, I become liable for it as if I am a thief. And a thief, therefore, is chayev. What's the difference? So a shomer is famously not chayev for all forms of damage that happen to something. Different shomerim are chayev in different things. So a shomer chinam. Right? A shomer, if I just ask Eitan to watch my computer and I don't pay him anything, I'm sorry. Right, I'm not paying you anything. Just please watch it for me. So then, he is only liable if something happens to it through his own negligence, through posheya. But if someone were to come in here and steal it from him, he would be exempt. Right? If someone is at the opposite extreme, what? That's not negligent. Negligent would be he was, or whatever. Right? That's the someone else steals it. He's not being paid. Why should he fight off a thief? Right? Right? It's not his job. If I hire someone, it is their job. If I let someone borrow something, so then who are the advantages fundamentally accruing to? The borrower. And therefore, he's chayav for basically anything except for, well, very specific cases. Right? But a thief is chayav for basically anything, right? So, someone who shaleach yad becomes liable, not from when he actually, from the moment he starts, but the Gemara says you might have thought that he only becomes a shaleach yad and therefore a thief with the full liability that it attaches to it. Now, why am I saying, well, isn't the liability that he has to return it because he stole the object, but he already had to return the object. He was only a custodian. Therefore, the manifestation of being Shaleach Yad is that if something happens to it, liability is increased. And the Gemara says that someone becomes considered a Shaleach Yad Al kol divar pesha. For every, now, davar can either mean a thing or a word, right? But al kol divar pesha, the Gemara darshans, on every word of sin, l'chayev al machshava kimaaseh, to make you liable for thought as deed. But what does Rashi pick up on in the case of shlichut yad? Davar. Al kol divar pesha. For every word, sinful word. And the Gemara calls that machshava, that you're chayev on machshava. So Rashi there assumes that when we say machshava, we don't mean machshava. What we mean is speech. Dilav motzi bepeh, machshava lo mayne chayev lei. That you could, but Rashi doesn't there. Okay, now, here. This is very simple. I mean, I could put it on the board. But what reasons do we have to believe that in all these areas of halacha, machshava means literal thought?
It says machshava.
Very good. It says machshava. That's the key in a lot of these, right? Very good. It says machshava. Why wouldn't we think it's machshava? So one is that in certain cases we're assuming liability. And liability requires proof. And it's very hard to prove what's going on in someone's head. The second, it could just be a...
Why can't it be a theoretical liability? Like, if we knew for a fact, we'd be liable.
So it could be. Again, we're going to have to be actually, but the first glance, the reason you would say it's not is because of there's implied liability here. And the second is could just be like a gut conviction that... Are you really chayav for that, what you think? Mm-hmm. Right? Meaning... going back to what you said last week, right? That was Evan's thing that week. Because you have what you think. Now, on the one hand, yes, I proved last week you do. But not always, right? Meaning you can say that you're chayav for thought and still say there's a difference, not always, not under all circumstances, right? Depends how concrete of a thought of it, right? So like if we used our examples last week, it's like, yes, do we think that someone is a good person if he sits there acting very nicely, but he constantly thinks he wants to kill you? No, we think that person's probably a bad person, right? On the other hand, if you have a very good friend who always acts nice and truly cares of you, but in a flash of rage, you know, thinks that they want to give you a slap across the face, but they quickly suppress that thought, right? And you don't even notice it, you probably are more forgiving of that, right? Because like, right, meaning we understand that just because in theory you could be chayev, you know, we can hold someone responsible for thought. Not all thoughts are created equal, right? So the two main reasons to oppose thinking that thought means thought is one is implied liability, which creates an epistemic problem for thought versus speech. Now, the possible solution, as Evan notes, maybe we have to start talking about theoretical liability, right? Meaning you should be chayev, we just can't prove it, but in principle, you are liable, even if in practice you're not, which doesn't always work when we start talking about malkut, because malkut implies not just theoretical liability, but liability, because you're talking about malkut. That implies that sometimes you're actually going to implement this. If it's all theoretical, it's all theoretical. Now, we'll get to that in just 1 second. The other is again, part of the reason why you might want to oppose assuming that something that machshava means machshava is a general opposition or minimizing, at least minimizing, of liability for thought. Now, again, is it possible that you're chayav for thought? Yes. Does that mean that we run to increase cases in which halacha actualizes? No, not necessarily, right? So Rashi, in the case of in Menachot, assumes that machshava by karbanot is speech. His proof is that we compare the case of karbanot to shlichut yad, and by shlichut yad we use the word davar. Now, as Evan says, well, how do you know by davar there means speech and not words that you think? Yes, there's going to be a machloket about that point as well. But Rashi, at least at this point, assumes that in both cases, they are speech, thought, machshava means speech.
But it's more than assumption, right? Doesn't he bring the reason, how could you hold someone by? How could someone
yeah, yeah. Right? Now, like I said, what I want you to do in each area, in each case, is to first figure out what the person holds, and then why they hold it. And when we figure out why they hold it, I want you to tell me whether you think that thinker makes the claim he does for local reasons. Meaning, there's something about this area of halacha that makes me believe that thought should be thought or thought should be speech? Or is it a conviction in general about halacha's approach to thought versus speech in Kol HaDeir Kula, which they just happen to be plugging in? Right? Those are not the same. Right? So here, Rashi assumes... Yes. Yeah, meaning that's what I want to ask, right? Meaning you have to ask in each area of halacha, is the person saying what they're saying because they believe that there is a general approach to halacha about thought versus speech? Or does the posek in question not think that's what's going on? They think that this area of halacha has certain requirements. Okay? So from this Rashi, let's first facts. Rashi thinks that karbanot, whenever it says machshava, it doesn't mean thought, it means speech. I mean, not action, speech, but speech. No, it's not. No, in halacha, it's not. No. Okay, let's be careful. Default. When we see lav she'in bo ma'aseh, we include thought as being non-active. What? Words are considered non-action. So, for example, lashon hara doesn't get malkut because it's a lav she'in bo ma'aseh. As in general, ma'aseh means action, not thought, and not speech. In certain areas of halacha, speech gets elevated to either that which makes you liable, or in certain cases that we already saw last week, sometimes we treat speech as an action. But speech is an in-between. So let's see, what does Rashi say here? So first of all, by karbanot, he thinks that, in Rashi Menachot, that speech is, that machshava rather means speech. By shlichut yad, speech. Why by shlichut yad does he think that it's speech and not thought? No. What did he say? Because of the word davar. Davar. That's what he quotes. I'll call divar pesha.
Well, isn't the end of the Rashi where he says the thing about the...
Right, so he says a few things. One is the word davar. The second point is that, yes, he says... Well, let's analyze everything he says. I'll call divar pesha. And then he said the second point is that the case of Shlichut Yad is clearly a case of actual liability in court. That's the context, which is, at what point do we know that the shomer has considered, one second, that the shomer has now started treating this as his own, such that if even in, you know, an unavoidable accident would happen, he would become liable. So called Dvar Pesha tells us that that happens as soon as he starts treating it as his own, based on Machshava, which Rashi then says in that case means Dibor. Next step that Rashi does, and this is the last step that we can analyze them, is that he says what's true of Shlichut Yad is true of Korbanot. Right? Those are all the moves that Rashi makes, correct?
Wait, is this a different Rashi? I thought he like explicitly makes the point, like, how could somebody be
tired? Yeah, we just said that. I want to go through every step that Rashi says. Rashi says, again, machshava here means dibor. Why? Step one, by shlichut yad, it says devar pesha. Step two is that it's not just a theoretical liability, it's a practical liability, which further reinforces his conviction that it must be something that's provable because you need liability. Right? And for liability, you need provability. And then his last step is to assume that because the Gemara compares Shlichut Yad and Karbanot, yes, that is, we'll see that, but that is the assumption in that Gemara. In that Gemara, it's talking about both. Yeah.
So
Chayiv doesn't, that in that case, doesn't mean Malkut. Chayev there means monetary liability. Chayev means liable. In the case of Shlichut Yad, it means monetary liability. Chayev doesn't always mean malkut. It only means malkut if you're talking about malkut. There you're talking about monetary liability. Okay? So now if I ask you, we got the facts down. Is Rashi making a universal claim? A local claim? Very good. So on the one hand, he invokes a pasuk, which implies that it's local. Right? On the other hand, he ends with a svara, which is that there's liability in court, meaning practical liability, not theoretical liability. And if there's theoretical liability, then that assumes epistemic access.
Wait.
I.e., speech, not thought. So correct. So there's a little bit of ambiguity here, which is on the one hand, he assumes that when he quotes the pasuk, it sounds like he's making a local claim by Shlichut Yad. And then he's comparing it to Karbanot and saying, okay, the Gemara compares it, so fine. But then at the end, he does seem to, as Rabbi correctly notes, venture out of the Gzeirat HaKatuv territory into a claim that not necessarily that whenever we say machshava, it must mean speech, but that whenever machshava implies liability in court, there must be speech either for epistemic reasons, though I'm not even sure that Rashi's clear, right? It may be, right? What does he say? When he says, Ilav motziu bepeh machshavto lemay nechayivle, if you didn't say it, for what would you be chayiv? It's not clear he's making a merely epistemic point. He could be making a fundamental point, which is liability requires a higher level violation. Right? Does he? I'm not. I'm saying it's not clear. Does he say that it's about epistemic? I'm just noting that in Rashi, it's not clear.
Well,
I tend to think he probably thinks it more epistemically, but technically, it's not what he says. He just says lemay nechayiv lei. Okay, good. Rashi and Kiddushin. Okay, also talking about Karbanot. It says shekin yeshnon b'machshava. Kachim nami idnu machshava. Rashi says that karbanot also are liable through, or karbanot are about thought. Yes?
Yeah, right.
And the invalidation of karbanot and pigol come through thought. Gamar bilibo lomar shor zeola. If I decide in my heart that it is a burnt offering, harehu ola, it is, kiditnan. And then he quotes a different case, right, where he says, you might have thought that it's only if you verbalize. Gamar bilimo minai. And how do you know that? Now, what is he talking about here? The commitment that you have to bring a karbon. Right? It's not. Talmud Lomar kolin nediv levolo. Good. So Rashi here, but he does talk about lo lishma and pigul, and he assumes that it is thought. He says that explicitly. And why? Because he says, just like I can commit to bringing a karban through pure thought, which the Gemara is quite explicit about, because the Gemara says, you might have thought you only become chayev through verbalization. But then it says, kol nediv lev olot. Hold on a second. So here's the problem, is that Rashi in Kiddushin is very explicit. The Rashi says, it's clear from the Gemara that I can become liable to bring a karban based on thought alone. Based on that, Rashi then makes the next logical move, which is, that shows that thought alone is halachically recognized in the realm of karbanot. Therefore, all the cases of invalidating a karban, which talk about thought, there's no reason to think that they're not about thought because thought is already a recognized category in Karbano. Now, there's a few things to note about Rashi. Again, is Rashi making universal claim that thought is always... No, he's arguing that this is local, that we have a special pasuk that tells us that thought is a relevant factor in the world of Karbano. Once we know that, by the commitment to bring a Karban, then it follows that thought is already significant in the world of Karbanot. So when I find the invalidation of Karbanot where the word Machshava is used, it is reasonable to believe that at least here, again, he doesn't say this is true universally, but that Machshava means Machshava, that it means thought. Now, what's the problem? Did Rashi in Menachot clearly said that thought for the invalidation of Karbanot is speech? And in Kiddushin, he clearly thinks that the invalidation of Karbanot happens through thought. Good. Right off the way. So how do we deal with this? So one possibility is to say that it's a machloket within Rashi, because Rashi sometimes does that. Why does Rashi do that? Very good. As Rashi, as it often is said in both traditional circles and academic circles, that Rashi is mifaresh b'makom. Rashi viewed his job as explaining the daf in front of him. And therefore, if there is a machloket ha-sugyot, if there is a dispute between sugyot, which sometimes happens, that the sugyot reflect different halakhic positions, Rashi will not necessarily try to make a coherent picture of shas. He will explain the daf in front of him. And therefore, if you have two Rashis in different mesechtot in the same sugya, he can say different things. Unlike whose methodology? What? That's right. Tosfot does not believe this. Tosfot believes that his job is, as the Yom Shul Shlomo famously says, to turn shas into a ball, right? To one ball, right? One big thing that all works together. Very good. So then all the svara that we've been saying would be true in two different sugya, that one sugya is convinced that...
I don't think what tells Rashi in the sugya that one svara...
Oh, so then you'd have to go through each sugya and figure out what is the diok that he has there. Okay. We'd have to figure it out. So that's one possibility. It's a machloket ha-sugya. But Akiva and Shlomo had a different suggestion. What was your suggestion?
Our suggestion is that when it's stated in Menachos, it's stated as really to a kiyah, whereas in Kedushin, it's stated merely in regards to Tzula HaKarba. Therefore, we may say that Machshava Stam is strong enough to be Mepasel with Karba, but not strong enough to be Mechayel.
Right, very good. So Akiva and Shlomo suggested in Seder, and now Shlomo articulated for us now, right? But I know you were thinking it, so it's okay. Fine. Wonderful. We have to be very careful, right? Which is, if we read Rashi carefully in Menachot, then as Rabbi noted correctly, Rashi's primary argument seems to be, he has two arguments. Part of it is quoting a pasuk, but part of it is a universalizable claim, which is liability seems to require speech for epistemic reasons, which is we cannot yet access what you are thinking. And therefore, if you are assuming liability in court, then what?
Then there has to be some epistemic access.
Then, yeah, right? That doesn't mean, as Evan said before, that you couldn't also talk about theoretical liability. And therefore, it could be that Rashi is saying, look, between you and God, it happens to be true that if you think lo lishma, the karban is a karban lo lishma. What's the problem? If you don't fess up, there's no way of knowing that. And therefore, we can't hold you liable because we can't know. But when after 120, right? If that's the case, then what is Rashi's fundamental opposition to treating Machshav, that thought, as sufficient, is epistemic. And therefore, whenever we're talking about liability in court that requires epistemic access, then he will assume that thought must mean speech. But in cases where it's not clearly talking about liability, he's not convinced. But what does that show you? If Shlomo and Akiva are right, does Rashi think fundamentally that thought is insignificant in halacha? No. Right? It would be that his conviction is that thought is significant. It merely lacks. It's just that when we have to deal with liability in court, we need epistemic access. And we're going to do that through speech. But therefore, let's say we would say, okay, if you want to make this carbon a carbon lolishma, you don't have to verbalize it. But let's say someone did verbalize it. Right? He did. He didn't have to, but he did. He was mumbling. Right? And someone heard him. Then Rashi would clearly hold. Yeah, he's liable. Because again, he was fundamentally, there was theoretical liability always. Practical liability requires proof. But if he does say, even if he didn't have to, he has no opposition fundamentally,
So that is another possible solution. So then we'd have to figure out, and then you have to deal with all the other epistemic problems that we have. Two witnesses, yeah. You have to apply the same rigor we do everywhere else. Okay. What does the Rambam think?
Unclear.
Unclear, very good. It's unclear, but because the Rambam just... The Rambam seems to hold that it's Machshava. Why? Because he doesn't say otherwise. Now, what's the only way to get out of that in the Rambam? Very good. Unless you have an a priori assumption that thought is insignificant, and therefore, whenever you say think, what you mean is say. Now, is that crazy? Now, that's not completely crazy, right? That's not completely crazy. So, I'll give you an example. Let me give you an example. Whoa. You're like, it's completely crazy. Oh, okay. Right? Let me give you, it's not completely crazy. Let me give you an example, okay? A good way of figuring out, of pointing to the fact that we might have a certain an a priori conviction like that would be if outside the world of halacha, we have evidence that sometimes when people say thought, they don't mean thought. Is that ever the case? Yeah. Take the admittedly dated aphorism, but it is, right? Or whatever, turn a phrase, right? Expression, which is a penny for your thoughts, right? What does that mean? It's quite dated.
Because
right, that's what it means, right? Is you say thoughts, but what we mean is, I'd like to know what you're thinking. Right? Right, that's what, right, that, exactly, right? It's that sometimes thought means, it implied, share your thoughts, right? We say thoughts, but what we mean is words. Why? Because I want to know what you're thinking. It happens to me that I won't know what you're thinking unless you share it with me. But that means that practically what I mean is speech. What I call it is thoughts, right? So it's not crazy. Sometimes we do, but again, you would think the Rambam, if he meant speech, would say it. He doesn't say it. I mean, just to prove that, Rambam Psula Mikdashin Gimel Aleph. Shalosh Machshavo. Hain, Shapos Karbana. There are three thoughts that invalidate Karbana. Ve'elo Hain. Machshevet. Shinoi Hashem. Thinking that it's going to be a different Karban. Machshevet Hamakom. Thinking it'll be in the wrong place. Machshevet Azman. Thinking about bringing the Karban at the wrong time. Machshevet Shinoi Yem Ketat. How do you think it? Zeh Shogun Zevesh Lolishmo. Goncha Ola Vichashev. Shushlamim. Oyishkate. Right? That word gets repeated over and over and over again. And if you just skip down to the last two lines, again, I could read the whole thing, but he does this over and over. Uzvachim shechashav bahen machshav azu, and a karban about which you thought this. Heim anikrim zvachim sheneshu chutz lizmanim veim nikrim pigal b'chomakom zeh pigal amor b'torah. Right? Rambam never says the word dibur. He says machshava machshava choshev machshava 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 chishet da 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 da. Now again, if you have a strong a priori assumption that thought is irrelevant in halacha, then you could say, well, the Rambam didn't say the words that thought means thought and not speech and don't think otherwise. Admittedly, he did not say that. But he thought it. I mean, you could do that. What? We're going to get to that. Don't worry. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to the cases of what happens if you meant one thing and said the opposite, right? Rather than you didn't say anything. We're going to get to that. We're not there yet. But hold that thought. Because, yes, what Evan is raising is a complexity. So far, we've only asked whether thought is sufficient or you need speech, right? We have not yet, but we've assumed so far that what we're dealing with is cases in which your thoughts are accurately reflected in speech, and the question is, do you need speech or not? There is a whole nother halacha that you have to deal with, which is, what happens if they're not in line with each other and not asking what is necessary, but when there's an actual tension between thought and speech? meaning I thought X, I meant Y.
You run into the same problem.
But also,
sometimes. Very good. And by Nidarim, we're going to see that this matters. Because sometimes we don't just require speech or thought. We require
alignment.
Speech alignment. Very good. There's the alignment problem, which is really an AI issue. But
fine.
What? There's a book, a very popular, very, very good book recently on AI called The Alignment Problem. What? Yes, because this is one of the major problems in AI is the alignment problem, which is not its thought and its action, but your thought and its action.
By the Doan, we say, stands in very specific cases that we assume the machshava follows whatever was then the dibor. And if someone goes back and says,
no, you don't really mean what I said, we don't believe.
Right, so we're going to get to that. We're going to get to that stuff. But hold off on that. First, we have to define speech and thought. Then we can deal with cases of lack of alignment. We're going to get there. Okay, very briefly, I want you just to look at Daf Tet Vav. In Zvachem, I didn't give you the entire piece in the Kilat Yaakov. You can believe me or not, but this is my shortened Makarot sheet. Because, like, you know, I gave you Kilat Yaakov, Zvachem, Aleph, right? I just made you look at the Gemara rather than his entire piece. This is shortened, yes. I'm sorry. So he points out there as follows. Itmar. So, again, we noted that one potential reason to believe that speech means thought is the epistemic problem. Right? The second is possibly a conviction that thought is irrelevant to halacha. The third is something that he points out on Daf Tet Vav, and that is, the Gemara there says, Itmar, holacha shelo biregel. Let's say you, remember, one of the avodot is halacha, is the taking of the blood to the Mizbeach. And the Gemara has a machloket about halacha shelo biregel. So if I shech over there and Mizbeach is over here, then I do what's called halacha biregel, right? Which is I walk. But what if I do it so close to the Mizbeach that I can bring it without walking? Right?
Is this different than this? But this is a different case where it's so close that there's no halacha whatsoever. Or is this bad case?
We're going to do that when we do halacha properly. For the moment, hold it. But the Gemara says, halacha zol b'regel, machloka rishon rabbanan. So Gemara says, behalacha rabati d'chloem elo pligi d'psula. Right? By a big halacha, even not b'regel, like stretching, you know, if you're tall, not like me, but you're tall and you have a large wingspan, right? So you can be several feet away and just, it happens to be that, you know, you are, what? You're a, whatever, you're a basketball player, professional. And you have a, I don't know, what's the wingspan of the of basketball players? I don't know.
7 feet.
7 feet? Is that it? I don't know.
It's long.
What? Okay, so my height is not so big, and, you know, those extra, like, 2 feet that they have over me is significant, you know? It's significant. Yeah. It's really, once in my life, I was like, one of my friends, his brother-in-law is 6'10". And it was a like college basketball player. So at their wedding, we have a picture of the two of us next to each other. And you realize just how much taller someone can be than you, you know. So yeah, big wings, man. So no one has, so he says, look, by halacha rabati cholam elo pligi dipsula. There, everyone agrees that. Now, specifically, we're talking about machshava, meaning having invalid machshava during halacha. That's the context here. So that everyone agrees it's invalid. Because that halacha counts as navoda, and therefore if you have machshava lo lishma during a significant halacha, then you had a psul machshava during avoda. Ki pligi, what's their machloket? But halacha zutarti. It's where it's very small. You don't have to do much. So Gemara says, mechachu alei b'marava. In Eretz Yisrael, they laughed at him. And they said, elachatat ha'of, the psula ba machshava, if you think that when something is quick and short, there's no psul machshava, then by birds, where the whole thing is not very. Yeah. The Rav Shimon, heyche mishkachat la. What is the case? If he thought about it before the blood comes out, lo klumi, it's irrelevant. The butter dinafik dam, and if it's after the blood came out, It's avid lei mitzvato. The mitzvah is done. So my kush, the Gemara says, why is that a problem? Dilma mi de parish va de matel mizbeach. Maybe it's in that time from when it comes out to when it gets in mizbeach. Da boy minei reb yirmi rizera. Mayamaze v'nikta yado shalmaze azur edam lavir mizbeach. Mahu. And the Gemara goes on about this for a few lines. Now, in the Kilat Yaakov, he points out that, wait a second, what does the Gemara say? How can you say that Machshava is going to invalidate? When do you even have time to have a psul Machshava? It's so quick, right?
A halacha
and the avoda on a bird, right? Yeah, right. Now, the Stipler, right, the Yisrael Yaakov Kanievsky, the author of Kilat Yaakov, also known as the Stipler Gaon, says, I don't understand. If Machshava means Machshava, what's the problem? Who cares about something, how fast something is? Right? You can't have a thought instantly. Thoughts are virtually instantaneous. So I'm thinking while I'm doing it, what are you imagining? Right? If I'm you're thinking it. He says, look, the fact that Gemara talks about timing and implies that something could be too fast for you to have a machshava leads him to believe that it might, that for him points in the direction that it's thought. Because if something is virtually instantaneous, you can't verbalize it, whereas you can think it. Now, this isn't a proof. It's not a proof, right? Now, push back on the Kilat Yaakov. This is his proof that machshava must mean dibur, because it seems to take up time. Now, what's the problem? Correct. You could say that either it's too fast for you to think, or thought might not mean like a fleeting thought. Even if you think it's thought, it might be like you articulate it in your mind, right? Meaning, has anyone ever done the... Has everyone ever done a speed reading course? Like Mamish trained to speed read? So one of the first things that they do is they notice that why is it that reading takes so long usually? Because you think you're thinking, you're not. You're verbalizing it in your head. You're reading it to yourself, which takes a long time. And one of the first things they try to get you to do, so if you really want to read fast, is to get you to think without verbalizing in your head. Right, so like I had a chavrusa who was very into this, that there was an app you could use, or you could do it on your computer, that what it would do is to train you to speed read, is that you would plug in the file you wanted to read, and it would flash the words by so fast that you didn't have time to verbalize it in your mind. And you would only think it, right, which would get you to much, much faster reading, right? So it could be that that the Stipler is not right. That it's just the Gemara is assuming that thought isn't that. Thought is mental articulation, which would take time. Right? But we would still have learned something important, which is that thought is mental articulation rather than, I don't know, general cognizance or whatever exactly you think is happening. Right? His point is simply that the thought that is here seems to take time. For him, that proves it's Zibor. I don't think he's right. You could say that what that proves is that it is thought, but it's mental articulation rather than... By the way, it is actually very painful. Yeah, if you know this. One of the things, if you actually try these apps, is that you will find at the beginning it's extremely uncomfortable. Right? Reading that way is uncomfortable because we're not used to it. We don't realize we're articulating. And when it is forcibly... When you are forcibly stopped from articulating it in your head, it's actually like a very weird... Yeah. If you are a good speed reader, like the definition of like a good speed reader was something like, I think it's 850, it's like 850 words a minute with 85% recall, something like that. 500 words a minute with 85% recall. No, not a minute. In 10 seconds. What was it? I don't remember. I remember that one year the guys gave me a test. They put me on one of these websites and to see whether I qualified as a speed reader, whether I would have 85% or more recall of like whatever it was, like not a minute. It must have been, no, that's a page a minute. That's easy. It was like 10 pages a minute. Something like that. Something like that. Like, yeah. Which I did. I mean, I did. I do speed read. So, like, I do, right? But like, it really is. When you're really speed reading, you're not reading in your head because you can't do it that fast, right? Yes, Robbie.
Okay, so two questions. First question. Okay, so why is this, like, just on this Gemara itself, not really the point we're taking from it, but, like, why would that be an objection to why would the fact that some avodas happen so quickly that thoughts can't really work, why would that be an objection?
It's evidence. What do you mean? That's evidence that meaning in order for you to imagine this, the Gemara is trying to imagine a scenario in which this machloket applies. In order for there to be machloket, the scenario it's imagining must be possible. Right? And the Gemara is saying, well, whether or not machshava during halacha that you don't need, during halacha zutrata, invalidates. Right? And he says that means that the Gemara is imagining a... No, maybe it is. Just that's it. It's a thousand words per minute. Okay. So that's speed reading. Anyways, yeah. Is that the Gemara says there's a machloket whether machshava during halacha zutrata, which is momentary, invalidates or not. So the Gemara says, well, when could you possibly even have had that machshava? Meaning, in order for there to be a machloket of whether it's relevant, it has to be possible. Right? And the Gemara is trying to figure out, well, how could it be possible? Sometimes the avoda happens basically in an instant. Right?
So this point is like...
And then you can't argue about something that is impossible.
Right, so that's why they bring it up.
Correct, exactly. So the Kilat Yaakov says, you see that the Gemara is arguing about the physical possibility of having machshava in a very short period of time. He says, but you can think basically instantaneously.
Well, what I mean is like, okay, so if you don't have machshava, so does that suggest you need a positive machshava? You don't have
good. So he proves from here that machshava must mean dibor, because that's why the Gemara can say it's impossible to speak that fast. And I'm saying that's not necessarily a proof, because it could be that what you could prove from here is not that you need dibor, but rather that you need mental articulation rather than general cognizance. Because sure, general cognizance, right, you could have instantaneous. Intuitions can happen basically, right? Intuitive actions, reflexes can happen basically instantaneous. But as speed reading shows you, mental articulation takes time. Maybe not as time as verbalization, but it still does take some time, quantifiable time, right? And not like theoretically quantifiable. I mean practically quantifiable. Right, that's the whole vort of speed reading, is that we can quantify how long it's taking you to read, to articulate things in your head. And that's why if we want to train you out of that, we got to torment you by making you look at these. Well, try.
Why does it make sense for the Gemara to say halacha that's not necessary, and then they say halacha zutra, a small halacha? That is necessary, right? How does that make sense? If that's not relevant, then fine. But I don't know. Well, okay, maybe it's not
right. You know, I mean, the Gemara is just simply saying, when is it, right? The Gemara is just trying to figure out, practically, when are you having this, the machshava about which there's a machloket, which implies that there is a time frame.
Wait.
Right?
I thought the more common situation would be, like, if you take a weird roundabout route to the Mizbeach and you, like, walk back.
Right, but that, the Gemara says, no, because remember the Gemara said that everyone agrees machshava will be significant. The Gemara said their machloket is only by halacha zutrata.
Right,
that's the point. The Gemara says everyone agrees that if you do halacha, right, that takes a while, halacha rabati, then machshava matters.
Okay, all right, I have other questions, but I guess...
It's right, I mean, that's the Gemara's whole point, is that everyone agrees that in when there's significant halacha, machshava matters. Right. They argue only on zutrata, but and that is momentary, right? That's exactly the point. Okay. Fine. So now that we've laid out some of the basic problems here, what we're going to do is, again, look broadly, is say, okay, we've seen that some of the issues here are local, but some of them are universal. And because some of them are universal, we need to look more broadly and say, okay, what does the Torah in general think about thought. Maybe, right? Maybe. But to fully understand, we do need to cast a wider net. So here I gave you just a few examples. The first Gemara here is probably the most important. So it's a bit long, but let's at least get it. Did anyone actually get to number six? Anyone? Okay. Maybe not, okay? Let me read with you. Six is actually probably going to be the most important on this, but let me at least read with you a short one, okay? Just to get you started in this. So look at number seven. Okay, the Gemara here is talking about how you say Shema. The Gemara says, Amar Kra, Shema. The first position says, what do we learn from the word Shema? That can be in any language that you understand. Okay? Ula Rebbe Nami. Now, Rebbe thinks that you have to say it in Lashon HaKodesh. The Gemara says, okay. Ula Achdiv Shema. Then what do you learn from the word Shema, if not that it can be said in any language? So what does he say? Ahu mi boile hashmeya le'oznecho mashata motzi b'picha. That not only do you have to verbalize, but you have to verbalize such that it is audible. So here it's very clear that what?
Audible
to yourself. Right? You must hear it. Right? And the Rabbanan hold that you don't need to hear it yourself. Now, in this case, it is clear that does thought count as speech? No. It's clear because the Gemara takes it as a given that you would not be Yodze thinking. What's the only machloket? No. Rebbe is 1,000,000,000% clear because speech alone isn't enough. Right? Meaning not only do you need speech for Shema, but you need audible speech. The Rabbanan, it's 98% clear. Because the Rabbanan, it seems quite clear that can you think Shema? No. Right? They're quite clear that you need to say it. The only thing that they say is that you don't need to hear it, but they seem clear that you need to say it. But on the one end, that seems to be clear, except is this a local halacha or a universal halacha?
So, as I understand it, you would say for Bravo, you can't get
it. So that's unclear here, right? By Shema, but this is Shema, not Bracha. We're going to do Bracha in a second. Shema, what does the Gemara seem to hold? Rebbe clearly holds you must articulate because he holds that even articulation is not sufficient. You need to hear it, which means that it's not just mere articulation. The Chachamim seem to hold that, at least for Shema, articulation is necessary. They just hold you don't have to hear it, but you do have to say it, right?
Why would there even be a Havamina to think it's thought? I don't see it.
Good, so why would there be a Havamina to think it's thought? Only if what? If you think that thought always counts.
Right, but the question, we're not going that way. We're going the reverse way. We're not saying speech thought.
Very good. So in this case, it's clear that thought is not significant, right? Now, is that because thought is never significant, or because Shema requires articulation? Which does it sound like? It sounds like the second. Very good. Again, I'm not yet proving anything. Here, I'm just noting that in this area of halacha, it seems clear that thought is discounted. It seems pretty clear. However, it also seems pretty clear that this doesn't prove anything about other halachot because it seems local to Shema.
And the whole thing about the Shema is it's about intention.
Good, right? So therefore, but right, like I said, this is, you see what I put here? I said places that clearly need speech. Right? All I'm pointing out, there are clearly areas in halacha where thought is not relevant, right? Or not sufficient, right? This is one example, but does that prove anything about ours? Not necessarily. Right? But it's important just to establish there are cases where, what? By tefillah, ideally, yes, but not li'ikuva, as Israel Isaac pointed out. Okay, you know what? I'm going to stop there because I want you to, seven was the least of the ones which is hard-hitting. By six and eight, you're going to see that the Gemara is going to explicitly address these questions with a more universal tone. The Shema one doesn't, but when you get to the Birchot Kriyat Shema and benching in number eight, as you're going to see, and you read it more carefully tomorrow, look at what the Gemara says. What is the Gemara's proof? Or what is the word derived from these halachot? Hearer kedibur dami. Does thought count as speech? Right, so you're going to see the Gemara is going to explicitly take up this sugya with a wider lens. So tomorrow, make sure to do 6 and 8. And then we're going to analyze all these different cases where it is ambiguous. Right, these are a few examples where it's not ambiguous, that you clearly need speech. But then we're going to get to truma. We're going to get to shlichut yad. We're going to do the writing of a sefer Torah, lishma there. We're going to do, obviously, come back to karbanot. And then later on, we'll get to the question of what if there was a contradiction between what you thought and what you said. And we'll talk a little bit about Shabbat, right? Thinking about non-Shabbos dick things, right? Where the Gemara explicitly distinguishes between thought and speech. Okay, but let's, for the moment, make sure that you read 6 and 8 carefully tomorrow. And it's very good. Because? Okay. Okay. Why do you assume the Daraita and Darabana are different?
Because you may well say.
You might. Good. I want your assumption because you're.
You might say that the Raisa, God hears your thoughts, the rabbis don't.
So you might. Good. But this is where we're going to have to analyze. Okay.